From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to Worldviews. The European Union is now pledging to help Italy after a boat capsized last week and killed hundreds of African migrants. Rebecca Cruz and I discuss how European governments are struggling with refugee and asylum policies.
And when you bring in those numbers of people, there are social consequences trying to take care of them. It's dealing with employment. We also have to remember that Europe is dealing with an employment crisis and has been for the last 5 years or so.
And later, I'll talk with Richard Clark. He's famously known for criticizing the Bush administration for not doing enough to stop 9/11. But he now focuses on issues of cybersecurity and intellectual property theft.
If you look at the new Chinese fighter plane, it bears a shocking resemblance to the US F-35.
The economic and intelligence war between the United States and China. After this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Rebecca Cruz, terrible news out of the Mediterranean. Last week, we had a massive tragedy. Small boat, 66-foot boat, carrying approximately 500 migrants, mainly from Africa, Somalia, Eritrea, Ghana, possibly, that set sail from Libya en route to Italy, a small island, Lampedusa, south of Sicily, trying to reach Europe, basically, entry into Europe, seeking asylum, you know, fleeing from whatever it is that they're fleeing. But their boat broke down. They started a fire to attract some attention, and this raged out of control. Everybody shifts to one side, and the boat capsizes, and now we have hundreds of migrants dead in the Mediterranean. 155 approximately have survived. I mean, a tiny rickety boat with this many people, the desperation, I can't imagine that would drive people to do this in the first place. But this raises all kinds of issues and debates about immigration and asylum in Europe. I mean, what are we to think about this going forward? Europeans, in fact, are outraged by this.
Well, unfortunately, this is a story that's a little too familiar in the United States. Obviously, we've seen this from the Caribbean and the South America at times. And actually, this is not the first time that there's been a tragedy like this on the Mediterranean. In 2011, there was a boat, a similar situation, boat that capsized with 213 people that died there. So we're seeing this happening quite a bit. And really, if we take into consideration Italy, we often think of Italy as being a country of immigrants, where people are leaving the country, many of them for the United States in the last century. And now in the last 20 and 30 years, Italy has really become a country of immigrants. And a lot of people are going through Italy. Generally, if you get into or past that border, you then have access to the entire European Union if you can get the asylum in this situation. In 2011, obviously, with the Arab Spring, we see these numbers increase significantly. There were over 30,000 people that made that crossing across the Mediterranean in 2011. In 2012, the number went down to about 15,000. And in this year alone, the first 6 months, we saw about 8,500 people make that crossing. So very significant numbers.
But hundreds and hundreds of people are dying trying to make this trek across the Mediterranean. I mean, German authorities have referred to the Mediterranean now as a mass grave for migrants. This year alone, Italy has rescued 16,000 migrants in the Mediterranean en route to Italy. I mean, you know, this calls into question their motivations. Are these people fleeing war and conflict, or are they, you know, looking for better economic opportunity? And does that play into this debate and discussion about whether these people are welcome? But, you know, the fact is that, you know, people are dying by the hundreds, if not thousands, searching for a better life in Europe.
It is heartbreaking. And as you mentioned, these are significant numbers, but it's causing a lot of political discussions in Europe because there are a couple of transit countries, Italy and Greece. And then you have a number of countries that take in many of these asylum seekers. About 70% go to Belgium, Britain, France, Germany, and Sweden. And when you bring in those numbers of people, there are social consequences trying to take care of them. It's dealing with employment. We also have to remember that Europe is dealing with an employment crisis and has been for the last 5 years or so. So there are huge ramifications here. So yes, there is a concern about the loss of life, certainly, but it's not an easy question to answer. Now, why are these people coming across? There's all sorts of reasons for this. As you mentioned, many of them are coming from parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, Somalia, Eritrea, coming through Libya and then coming across. We know of the unrest in the northern African region in the last couple of years, so that has further pushed them across the Mediterranean, looking for better lives, looking to escape from persecution, multitude of reasons, and very, very heartbreaking.
Well, clearly, this does raise this larger issue of how we approach migration, how we deal in a larger sense. I mean, this goes beyond Europe. You know, the United States has this issue, of course, all around its borders. Other parts of the world, migration is something that is a global phenomenon. And so the question is, should we change our approach and think about migration in a different way and try the best we can to prevent these types of atrocities in the future?
Well, and the European Union has made promises to try to do that. They're going to re-examine their asylum laws, and hopefully some progress will be made there as well as elsewhere.
Well, Rebecca, thank you as always for joining me and providing your insight.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment for Rebecca or me, send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. You can also find all of our past interviews on our website, kgou.org. Coming up, I'll talk with former Clinton and Bush administration counterintelligence czar Richard Clark. Since leaving the National Security Council in 2003, he's focused on cyber attacks carried out by foreign governments and hackers, particularly from China. I'm Suzette Grelot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. In 2004, my guest Richard Clark testified during the 9/11 Commission hearings that many people inside the Bush administration were distracted from efforts against al-Qaeda due to a preoccupation with Saddam Hussein and Iraq. He served four U.S. presidents in intelligence and counterterrorism roles before leaving the National Security Council a decade ago. He now focuses on issues of cyber terrorism and the theft of state secrets and intellectual property, particularly between the United States and China. Richard Clark, welcome to Worldviews.
No, it's good to be with you and good to be in Norman.
I want to start by looking back a little bit to your days in government. You came to be known as, I guess, the counterterrorism czar, and you're really best known at that point in time for trying to warn the government prior to the attacks of 9/11 about al-Qaeda and what you saw coming. How and why did you know that this was going on, and how and why did this go unheeded?
Well, I think it was pretty obvious, certainly by the mid-1990s, that the United States faced a threat from a new terrorist group. The group al-Qaeda had actually organized in 1989, but we didn't really know that at the time. And it took the CIA a while to detect the existence of this organization. But then it began attacking us. And certainly by 1998, when it blew up two American embassies in East Africa, it was very obvious that the group existed. And its agenda was to attack what it called the far enemy, the United States, so that it could topple the near enemy, the Saudi government, the Egyptian government. They thought that the United States was propping those governments up. And that in order to replace them with religious fundamentalist Islamist governments, caliphates, theocracies, that they had to get the United States out of the Middle East. And the way to do that, they thought, was to increase the pain level to the United States so that we would leave. They didn't understand how the United States would react. And so it was very clear that that group was there and was organizing, and there was a lot of intelligence. And the Clinton administration slowly came to this realization and then became preoccupied with it. And President Clinton decided to change the rules so that we could actually assassinate the leadership of al-Qaeda. That was a big step, and it reflected his understanding of what the nature of the threat was. It was the first time that the United States had done that sort of thing, had a hit list to go after people and kill them. And then the Bush administration came in, and it was a very good team, we thought, of trained national security specialists, people who had held jobs in the national security apparatus in the past. But they came in somewhat preserved in amber from 8 years before when they were in the government, and they took up the same agenda that they had 8 years earlier. And they refused to believe that the world had changed fundamentally and that the largest threats to the United States were not from China or Russia, but were in fact from non-state actors. And they really couldn't believe that. And so they went about their preconceived agenda, ignoring what was the new threat.
So the purpose, obviously, of the attack was to get us out of the Middle East. And what it did was it got us more involved in the Middle East. It completely didn't – that strategy didn't work. You were an outspoken critic of the invasion of Iraq, and we now know from history what happened there. But kind of bringing us forward, how are we doing now? I mean, how have we ever gotten it right, this counterterrorism activity? I mean, we have these recent attacks in Kenya, for example. What are we to do? What are we to make of the government's efforts to try and counter these types of threats?
Well, the United States has destroyed most of the leadership of al-Qaeda. It's destroyed the central organization of al-Qaeda. The Obama administration really stepped up the use of drones to attack al-Qaeda, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. It quadrupled the number of attacks from the small number that the Bush administration was using. And by doing that and by cooperating with a number of regional governments, we really have over the past 5 or 6 years suppressed the threat from the central al-Qaeda organization. But the philosophy of al-Qaeda has spread, and various regional groups that would have existed anyway have now called themselves al-Qaeda because that's a popular thing to do. It gets them world attention. It gets them money from various people. It allows them to recruit from outside of their own region. And so we have these groups in North Africa and East Africa calling themselves al-Qaeda, groups in Iraq and Syria calling themselves al-Qaeda. And they reflect a movement in Islam, a minority movement, designed to create these caliphates and religious governments. And I think that's going to go on for probably as long as we're alive. It's a historical trend that has to work itself out in those regions. I think they represent a distinct minority. And for the most part, I think they will be suppressed. But it's for that region to figure that out. What our goal, as the United States should be, I think, is to make sure that those organizations don't threaten us or our interests, that they don't attack Americans in the region, they don't attack the United States back here. Unfortunately, some of them still have that old al-Qaeda philosophy of attacking the far enemy. And so we see the group in Somalia, for example, trying to recruit Somali Americans, train them, and send them back to do attacks in the United States. But the U.S. government's gotten very good at finding these people and preventing attacks. It's gotten much, much better than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
My guest is former counterintelligence czar Richard Clark, who now studies cyber attacks and espionage by foreign governments and hackers. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Let's get back to my conversation with former National Security Council advisor Richard Clark. When we left off, he described how terrorism and the United States' response to al-Qaeda have evolved over the past decade. So let's talk about something that you've written about more recently, and that is cyber war and cyber terrorist attacks. Is this really where we have not gained much in terms of being able to address it? And is this really the threat that is even more concerning, not the bombs and bullets and attacks of, you know, your average everyday terrorist with a weapon?
I think for a lot of people, a threat is not a threat unless people die. And with the cyber war and cyber activities in general, It's very rare that anyone dies as a result. But hundreds of billions of dollars move. Cybercrime works. Almost no one ever gets arrested for cybercrime. Cybercriminals live in sanctuary countries where they're not prosecuted for the most part because they bribe the governments in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And cyber can destroy things in the real world. We saw in Saudi Arabia recently where 30,000 computers running the Saudi oil company, Aramco, were wiped out. Their hard drives were destroyed. They became doorstops. That's an example. Another example is the United States attacking the Iranian nuclear facility at Natanz, where the American attack destroyed hundreds of centrifuges, the devices that were making the nuclear fuel. And so rather than blow that building up with a missile, rather than hit it with a bomb, we hit it with a cyber attack. And that was successful for a while. It destroyed a number of centrifuges and retarded the Iranian program for perhaps as long as a year. So this capability exists, but it's difficult for people to understand.
So to bring some clarity to it then, I mean, you've written about how China, for example, and it's fairly well known that China has engaged in attempts to steal secrets of all kinds or, you know, to engage in international property issues in terms of, you know, stealing designs to things or recreating designs of medications or whatever it is. But you've written about how the Chinese are actively engaged in cyber espionage. And again, that goes back to kind of the thousands, you know, millions, perhaps billions of dollars are lost, not so much lives. But is this the wave of the future? Is this what we are to be concerned about next? When will that ultimately lead us to think we are under attack and threatened by this sort of thing?
Well, I think the U.S. government believes it's under attack by China, and that the United States private industry, private sector is under attack. And what's going on is the Chinese are stealing from every company in the United States that has any intellectual property, any research and development, any market information of value. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, has said there are only two kinds of companies in the United States, those that have been hacked and know it, and those that have been hacked and don't yet know it. It is pervasive. And because it's automated, tens of thousands of companies can be attacked a day. And they're attacked by the Chinese in ways that are not detectable initially by most companies. They don't have the technology to detect it. And so the result is American taxpayers, American stockholders are paying for research and development, and the Chinese companies are getting that for free. And you cannot compete in a world economic marketplace where your opponent in the marketplace has lower wage prices, lower economic costs because of pollution regulations, and also doesn't have to pay for R&D because you're paying for their R&D. And that's what's going on. It's an economic war, and it's going on every day. And the Obama administration has been trying to get a bill through Congress to deal with the cyber threat. But Congress, as you know, doesn't like to pass legislation anymore.
Well, that's a whole different issue. But the stealing of threats, I mean, it's not just about, as I mentioned before, kind of medication or patents or things like that. But, I mean, you know, weapons designs, various other, I mean, you know, there's
certainly
a strong connection here, not only between the economic warfare and the espionage that goes on to steal information relevant for economic production of goods and services and trade, but, you know, weapons and things that can actually harm us. So there is that connection, even if it might
absolutely
be indirect.
I mean, if you look at the new Chinese fighter plane, it bears a shocking resemblance to the U.S. F-35. If you look at the U.S. Predator drone, it looks exactly like the Chinese drone. This is no accident. They have been able to hack their way into U.S. companies and steal these designs. So they're ahead with their weapons development from where they would normally be. But the other threat is that perhaps when they get into these U.S. weapons companies, they leave behind a back door in the code. And the threat that some generals have mentioned privately is what if we ever get into a war with China, God forbid. But what if we ever get into a war with China and they have some switch they can throw that stops our weapons from working because they've put a backdoor in the code of our weapons? And you know, weapon systems today, well, heck, your car today, it's all code. The average American car has between 20 and 25 computers running it. The average 777 Boeing airplane has 30, 40 computers running it. So everything is run by computers and everything is run by code. And if you can get into that software and put malicious backdoors in it so that you can gain control remotely, then you can stop things from working. And that's the real threat, I think, with American weapons, is our weapons are so advanced, that so dependent on software. If the Chinese have been able to manipulate that software without our knowing it, then our weapons might not work when we need them to.
And, of course, this is true of power grids and the stock market and all kinds of other things that operate on a daily basis.
The president said something really interesting in his State of the Union address in February. He said, "We know that foreign entities are hacking their way into U.S. financial institutions, the U.S. power grid, and the air traffic control system." Now, all of that was classified secret or top secret before he said it. Well, the president has the right to declassify things to explain problems to the American people, so he did. But think about that. Foreigners are hacking their way into the financial networks and the electric grid control system. That means, and I've been saying this for a while, that it's possible to shut off the electric power grid, portions of the grid, if you can get into the control system. And there's every reason to believe that that is possible, and we haven't done enough yet to defend the electric grid.
So given this situation in the last minute that we have left, what, in a nutshell, can and should the United States and the international community do to address this very real problem?
Well, I think the international community has to establish norms of behavior and then enforce them. If China is going to violate those norms by stealing intellectual property and R&D, if it's going to do things like hack into electric power grids, then there have to be sanctions, and the United States has to lead that effort. And we have to say to China, here are the standards. If you violate them, there will be a price to pay, and that price has to be heavy.
Well, Richard Clark, thank you so much for sharing these interesting stories with us today and making visible, really, for us something that perhaps isn't on a daily basis. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Richard Clark, a former National Security Council senior advisor who now studies cyber attacks by foreign governments. You can read an excerpt of his book, Cyber War, and his 2012 New York Times article, How China Steals Our Secrets, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.